This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and happy Africa Day from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhim in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Bottom line is, things at this point in time, even though it's unpredictable what will happen, certainly look better than what we saw in West Africa at this point in time.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, talking about the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Details next. Also, Uganda is appealing for more donor funding to support its ever-increasing refugee population. And at least 50 people died when a boat capsized on a river in DRC's remote northwestern region. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story, it's still touch and go as to whether the Democratic Republic of Congo will be able to contain its Ebola outbreak. While the DRC has reacted quickly and the World Health Organization is vaccinating those who are most at risk, the disease still could spread. It already has gone from two remote areas to Mbandaka, a city of more than 1 million people. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the U.S. National Institutes of Health and helped develop the vaccine. He spoke with VOA's Paul Alexander about how the situation is playing out and about the various emerging treatment options for Ebola, which has been a death sentence for so many.
It is really tough to predict where this is going to go. There are some mitigating factors favoring the control of the outbreak so that it doesn't become like what we saw in West Africa in 2014 and 15. And there are some factors that are worrisome. Bottom line is, things at this point in time, even though it's unpredictable what will happen, certainly look better than what we saw in West Africa at this point in time.
Have you been involved in this outbreak at all?
Yes, we have. First of all, as you know, the vaccine that has now been deployed to Democratic Republic of the Congo, the VSV vaccine that was used in a ring vaccination study in West Africa in 2016, that was a vaccine that we helped develop. We did the phase one trials here at the NIH as well as in West Africa. Also, we've developed a couple of therapies, monoclonal antibodies that we've developed here at NIH over the weekend. The Minister of Health of the Democratic Republic of the Congo contacted me and asked if we could send him some of the monoclonal antibody, which is referred to as monoclonal antibody 114, if we could send it to the Democratic Republic of the Congo for them to potentially use in a clinical trial protocol. I have agreed to do that. We're in the process of getting it cleared through the WHO.
So what would this do?
It's a therapeutic approach. It's to passively transfer antibodies to an infected person to essentially counter the effects of Ebola.
So looking and reading the reports about what's going on over there, what are your impressions?
I think that the Democratic Republic of the Congo health authorities are doing a very good job thus far. There's been HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, here in the NIH has pledged to give several million dollars to the effort. The World Bank has pledged to give several million dollars to the effort. So I think things are, on track. Obviously, it's a tenuous situation, and you never couldn't predict what's happening. But I think the response thus far has been very good on the part of everyone involved.
How worrying is it that these three patients had escaped quarantine and got out into the public for a little while?
Well, that's always of concern, and that's the reason why you immediately have to do the contact tracing, namely to look at who their contacts were, observe them, and make sure if they develop disease that we put them into the appropriate treatment units. So it becomes laborious because they expose themselves, obviously, to several people when they escape from the treatment unit. But the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC health authorities, are in the process of doing the contact tracing of the people that they may have come into contact with.
What do you think about the MSF talking about how they're getting pushback and lack of understanding from residents there? Some people saying that this is all witchcraft. People saying, you know, I don't want to be treated.
That all the time. Well, whenever you have an outbreak in countries in Africa, we had the same issue in West Africa, that some people were pushing back on the authorities that were trying to help them. So that's not a surprise. I mean, obviously, it's something you have to deal with to the best of your ability to sort of make sure that we can get the people into the appropriate treatment. You're going to have that kind of a pushback and disinformation.
So how do you deal with it? I know that they're trying to
Deal with it the best way you can.
Are there other things that you're working on?
There are other treatments that are being considered. You know, the ZMAP antibody that we used in West Africa, that is now being deployed. It's already in West Africa and in Mali. If they want to use it there, and again, this will all be up to the discretion of the Minister of Health of the DRC. So ZMAP is going to be available. Gilead has an experimental drug. I already mentioned the monoclonal antibody 114 that we have. And then a company called Regeneron also has a monoclonal antibody. All these things are in the experimental phase, but they are available for use if the DRC wants to use them.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander. Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo today said at least 50 people died when a boat capsized on a river in a remote northwestern region. The vice governor of Chupa province, Richard Mboye Iluka, told news agencies the accident occurred Wednesday night on the Momboyo River. The boat was taking people from the town of Monkoto to the city of Mbadaka. Officials say it is not clear what caused the accident and that an investigation team is on the way. They also do not know how many passengers might still be missing or how many survived. Refugee agencies and Uganda's government are appealing for more donor funding to support the country's ever-increasing refugee population. They say they have only managed to secure 10% of the required funding for refugees, as well as cater for host communities this year. They warn that the inadequate funding is likely to cause a big crisis as far as extending services to refugees is concerned. VOA's Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Uganda is currently hosting the highest number of refugees in the country's history, nearly 1.5 million people, and is receiving simultaneous emergency influxes from South Sudan, DRC, and Burundi. They join smaller numbers from Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Sudan. But as the country continues to open its doors to the refugees, the numbers seem overwhelming. This is coupled with chronic underfunding of the refugee response, which is said to threaten the ability of the government and of humanitarian organizations to continue to deliver critical assistance. Joel Botro is the UNHCR representative to Uganda. He says they've received $40 million this year for the care of refugees and their host communities. The problem is that over 10 times that amount is needed.
We're in a dire financial situation. We cannot continue being at 10% funded, more or less, overall. We need resources so that we can continue this job. Otherwise, we run the risk of, in fact, not being able to sustain the efforts.
He says the underfunding is undermining their ability to provide basic services to the large refugee population.
World Food Programme may totally disrupt its own food pipeline, and you can imagine what that does. On our side, you know, we will not be able to continue catering for the level of education we provide through partners. Health is the same thing, and this could create a very problematic situation on the ground. We should remember that the host population, but also the refugees, have a right to access to basic services. If we don't provide that, discontent may grow.
Botry warns that if the trend continues, it poses a great threat to Uganda's highly praised refugee model.
Uganda is a model for the rest of the world, frankly, in terms of its generosity and so on. Making that fail would be really going contrary to the Solidarity Summit, contrary to the New York Declaration, you know, on refugees and host communities, to the global compact that is supposed to be taking place sometime this year in New York, whereby donors are pledging to sort of support refugees.
Uganda is currently operating a comprehensive refugee policy where each person is entitled to a 50-by-50 plot of land for cultivation and settlement materials for construction of shelter and daily food rations for a period of at least 1 year. They are also integrated to access health care and education within the community they live in. Hilary Onek is Uganda's Minister for Refugees and Disaster Preparedness. He says that Uganda might have to rethink its policy to suit the available funding.
We give these people land where they settle. We give them security where they should be protected. They go to our health centers for medical treatment. Their children go to our schools. They benefit from our services, the services designed for a limited number of people, now it is catering for about 5 times. It's too much for a small country like ours. We need the international support. Without that, we may change our policy to make sure that we don't get all this burden.
The appeal for more funds comes in the wake of allegations of gross mismanagement, fraud and corruption in Ugandan refugee operations. A number of donor agencies have threatened to withdraw their support if the UNHCR or the government fail to take action. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. Seventeen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. It's still touch and go as to whether the DRC will be able to contain its Ebola outbreak. Uganda is appealing for more donor funding to support in support of its increasing refugee population. And at least 50 people died when a boat capsized on a river in DRC's remote northwestern region. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Mental illnesses are the most common health conditions around the world. In Liberia, people of all ages suffer from various forms of mental illnesses, many stemming from years of conflict and the devastating impact of the Ebola crisis, which left many children without parents and millions of people traumatized. VOA's Kim Lewis visited the Soniwin Health Center in Monrovia, where mental health services are helping people improve their lives.
At the Soniwin Health Center in Monrovia, mental health clinician Ibiasen Duako told me his day consists of treating people with mental health illnesses and conditions such as anxieties and substance abuse, in addition to any other medical conditions they might have. He said caring for people with mental illness is something he has always wanted to do.
When I was in the medical school, in the nursing school, this was something I was yearning for, that I wanted to deal with people who might possibly be marginalized and not given care to. So I feel so much proud. I always want to be with them, yeah, because I feel not everybody wants to attend to them. So, but Carter Center have opened our eyes through this training, and I feel very, very much pleased working with mentally ill patients.
Duako also pointed out that the training helped him to dispel misconceptions he had about people with mental illnesses.
One of the things that was always said was people with mentally ill conditions are most often violent. When I entered the school, I got to know that they are not always violent. Most of the time they are being provoked. For example, if somebody came for treatment today, you were diagnosed of typhoid or malaria, they're not going to change your name to typhoid or malaria. But if a mentally patient come, they call them by their condition. You crazy man. And they go as far as even calling us, the clinicians, crazy people, doctors. I believe if you tell somebody that you are crazy and they guess angry with you, they could react. But sometimes their reaction may not be directed to you. They hit another person who is not involved in the process.
Corpo Monina, an RN and mental health care trainer at the clinic, highlighted treatment is not always about prescribing medication.
Some of them can come, we don't even give them medication, but based on the way we talk to them, we counsel them, then they can go back home. And some of them, when we see that they are really depressed and they need the medication.
Moinina said once you put a patient on a particular medication and the clinic runs out of it, they may be able to put the person on another drug until the medication is restocked.
But if there is any means that really that we can impress them just for them to come for their own self-medication, it will be fine. Even for psychosis cases, but they don't come.
One reason the clinics run out of medications is because patients will not go to the pharmacy and buy them. Instead, they go to the clinics where medication is free. This is just one of the many challenges facing some clinics. Another challenge is changing the mindset of healthcare workers that most cases of mental illnesses are treatable.
So once you see somebody have problem, it's like, okay, this person just need to live their life. There's nothing they can do. They can offer society, so let them move on with what they are doing. That's why we are so grateful to Dr. Cooper and the Carter Center family.
At the Sonny Wade Health Center in Monrovia, Kim Lewis, VOA News.
The United Nations is urgently appealing for $280 million to provide life-saving aid over the next 6 months for more than 1 million people displaced by conflict and drought in Ethiopia. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, says emergency operations must be urgently scaled up, namely for the people in the border areas of Ethiopia's Oromia and Somali regions. The two communities have been engaged in a territorial dispute for the past year, involving competition over resources, including wells and grazing land. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says 2 years of back-to-back drought worsened living conditions and that those regions require immediate life-saving aid because they are in a state of crisis.
We have a humanitarian situation that needs a very comprehensive response. Many of those who are affected are pastoralists. When they are displaced from where they have grazing opportunities and so on for their livestock, that is very, very disturbing, also both in the immediate but also in the medium and longer term needs that will emanate from that.
Earlier this year, the United Nations launched its Ethiopia Humanitarian and Disaster Resilience Plan, seeking $1.6 billion to assist nearly 8 million people. The plan is 34% funded. Laerke says the most critical needs for those in the Oromia and Somali regions include emergency health and nutrition services. Other priorities include water and sanitation, access to education, and improved basic living conditions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Muslim Americans and their Islamic organizations use the holy month of Ramadan to enhance interfaith dialogue and teach non-Muslim Americans about Islam. The Embassy of Oman in Washington developed a new theme for its iftar to foster closer ties between Oman and the U.S. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi has the story.
Hanan El-Kindi, the information attaché at the Embassy of Oman, says each year the embassy's iftar promotes themes that characterize different sides of Oman. This year's iftar linked to Oman's history as a trading center.
The theme of the event, it's about small and medium business enterprise, entrepreneurship. And the people who came from Oman, they came to present themselves and to search and look for opportunities to invest in the United States and to have this kind of relationship between them and the people who are in the market here.
Oman, historically, was a trading, cultural, and political hub for much of East Africa. At the iftar, the embassy took the opportunity to update that legacy by connecting small and medium businesses in Oman to Americans. Muna Al-Khusaybi is an Omani jewelry designer who started her own business a year ago.
When I come here, it was for me the first steps to start our franchise with the American people here. So I hope it can work.
She was encouraged by the appreciation of her display of Omani handcrafted jewelry at the iftar and hopes that one day her products will become a trademark in the U.S. Salim Al-Wahebi is the owner of an Omani company that produces personal hygiene products made of natural ingredients. He came to the iftar with a message to the U.S. business community.
My message is taking advantage of our fair trade agreement between Sultanate of Oman and the U.S., where we can have the mutual business. And we are looking for the mass market here in the U.S.
The former mayor of Washington, D.C., Adrian Fenty, says Ramadan is a good opportunity to build on strong historic relations between Oman and the United States.
The two countries have such great relations. There's a 200-year relationship with the United States and Oman that continues all the way up until today.
For other guests, iftars like this one are cultural openings. Gerald Feierstein is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs.
This is an opportunity for people, particularly those who haven't lived in the Middle East, who have the same kind of familiarity with the religion, with the customs of the Middle East, to gain some understanding, to deepen the relationship and the ties between the two people.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
The evening, which included the call for evening prayers to break the fast, was a spiritual and cultural gathering to celebrate not only the end of the day's fast, but also Oman's legacy of international ties. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Lawyers today said they had filed an appeal of the death sentence imposed on a young Sudanese woman convicted of killing her husband. The case of Noura Hussein, who is 19, has drawn international attention to the issues of child marriage and women's rights in Sudan. Hussein's family allegedly tried to marry her off when she was 15. She fled and lived with an aunt for 3 years until she was tricked into coming home last year and forced to marry. When she refused to consummate the marriage, her husband had relatives hold her down while he raped her. When he attempted to rape her again, she stabbed him. Her legal team's appeal argues that the sentence should be overturned because Hussein was a victim of forced marriage, rape, and a denial of justice. The United Nations and human rights organizations have slammed her sentence imposed earlier this month. The UN has called on Sudan's government to make domestic abuse and martial rape illegal. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Happy Africa Day. Africa Day is the annual commemoration of the founding of the Organization of African Unity on the 25th of May, 1963.